Hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. On today's show, we have two great films. The Canadian drama Mouthpiece, which was adapted from a play, and the Egyptian film Yomadin. First off, with Mouthpiece, you'll be hearing from the director, Patricia Rosema, as well as the stars and creators, Amy Nustbakken and Nora Sadala, who originally created the two-woman play that Rosema saw and said, I wanted to adapt this into a film. We had a bit of a technical glitch with the interview with Aboubakar Shoki, the director of Yomadin. The interview went well, and then I had a technical glitch with my computer, and the first few minutes of the interview with Shoki were lost. I did my best to recreate the first question as best I could, but if it feels incomplete, you'll know why, and that there was something missing in terms of perhaps the stream of consciousness or thought. But that's for later. First up is the film Mouthpiece. Mouthpiece was originally created as a play written by and starring Amy Nustbakken and Nora Sadava, which they started writing, I believe, in 2013, 2014, and first premiered in 2015. And it's about, it's two women portraying sort of the inner conflict of the same character, Cassandra, in prepping for her mother's funeral and the eulogy she wants to give. Great Canadian director Patricia Rosema saw it and said, I think this quirky little sort of experimental theater piece could make a really good film. She later called Jodie Foster and her partner Alexander Hedison when they were looking for things to do in Toronto and recommended this play to them. And if the name Patricia Rosema sounds familiar, it's because she's been the director of such great films as I've Heard the Mermaid Singing, When Night is Falling, Mansfield Park, Tell Me You Love Me, Kit Kittredge and American Girl, In Treatment, Michael Tuesdays and Thursdays, and she also directed episodes of Mozart in the Jungle, and as well has written Grey Gardens. This is my conversation with Patricia Rosema, Amy Nustbakken, and Nora Sadava on their film Mouthpiece. I am privileged to be joined by Patricia Rosema, Amy Nustbakken, and Nora Sadava. Ladies.
Well done.
Hello.
Hi.
Welcome.
Hi.
How's it going today?
Good. Excellent.
So the film is Mouthpiece.
That's right.
Amy and Nora, I know this was a two-person play that you had wrote and performed a couple of years ago, and you saw it, Patricia. What made you, when you saw it, what made you think this will make a good film?
Just the whole atmosphere of it. It was strong, it was funny, and it was smart. And I thought, those are good. Those are good things. And, you know, it just felt like it spoke to something I got. I got, you know, what it was to lose a mother. I got what it was to kind of grapple with misogyny that you've sort of inhaled and comes out of you in all these ways that you never expect. And, you know, the constant need to be reevaluating everything we do to see if it's just basically informed by the patriarchy, but do that with fun and with music and with movement. But a big thing that I loved was that it was two people being one person. So it was like two heads inside one head. And I thought, that's genius. I just loved that. Loved it because I know that feeling and I know everybody knows that feeling. So I thought, okay, like somehow capture this. First thought TV show. I don't know because, you know, there's lots of money in TV right now. But then we talked about that and then that didn't fly. And then thought feature, add a mother, Bob's your uncle.
What was the process for you? Like back when you did the play with your company, where did the original idea come from?
Remember, no old answer. we're trying to never say anything in this interview that we've said before because some old thing said something.
That'll be hard.
Try. Make something up new. No, true, but new.
Well, I had an idea for a play about women. Wanted to do a play about female relationships. So then, and I had met Nora, we didn't know each other. And so I hired her and I said, let's get together in a room for 5 days and bash something out. And then realized we worked really well together. So then 3 years later, it evolved into, we were hitting a wall. We couldn't make this, it was really, we were struggling to find what we wanted to say. And then we had a feminist awakening. We realized we were giant hypocrites and that we thought we were one way. We thought we were living by our own rules and then realized none of these rules are ours. These rules were created by men. We're in a structured, aka patriarchal system we live in. We have no control. Even our inner thoughts, even our most private thoughts, even when I'm alone in the shower, naked, looking at my own body, I'm imagining there are dudes in my eyeballs. And I had never said that out.
Sick.
It's sick, right? It's perverse. It's like demented. And most women are walking around feeling demented, but not knowing that they're feeling demented. And when Nora and I would share these kinds of confessions to each other, be like, yeah, I know, I feel that too. The most private, ridiculous things you could imagine admitting, one would say to the other. I'm trying to think of something really shameful. I don't know. I mean, that's pretty bad. And the other one, even funnier things like, yeah, when I was eating on the toilet the other day, you know, things like that.
Well, one of the things was also like, these are the tricks I play when I go into a bar. I sit in the corner. I order a whiskey and a beer to look a certain way. I pull out a leather notebook. I let my shirt slip slightly off my shoulder.
By accident.
And it was like, oh yeah, those are my tricks too.
That particular one was a crazy one because the provocation, the way we often write is we'll have a provocation and then we go off right in for 20 minutes and show each other the work. And the provocation was like, how to get a guy or something. Identical. Leather bound notebook. It was like,
why was the leather bound?
I don't know. Because it's
I have a leather bound.
Influenced by Hemingway, just like influenced by all the male writers writing about women as we're talking about, or just writing about men.
And the whiskey and the beer, what was
same
that say to the guy?
That you're a guy's guy.
You're
not ordering sex on the beach.
You're having white wine.
You need a chaser, a good hard drinker.
But this is also, think about cinema, like all the movies we've seen where it's like the prissy girl is annoying and we see insight into the men want the girl who like is kind of tough but also like plays by her own rules. And
just watch
but
she likes sex a lot.
She loves sex.
Olivia Wilde plays a woman. I'm like, this was written by a man.
Which one?
Hands down.
What's it called?
Every movie.
Really?
I don't know.
Yeah, you've got to see her movie now.
Oscar Isaac?
Yes, that movie.
And Olivia Wilde.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which one
I'm watching this movie and I'm like, oh, okay.
She made me watch it.
What was it?
Oh, was that the one by Dan Fogelman, right?
Yeah.
It's like three different stories.
Sam Jackson is in there.
Antonio Banderas. Yeah, okay. It's like three different...
This is a great example of a woman who's... Written by a man, because you're going, oh, yeah, she's really sexy, but not in that room. She just ate a whole plate of brownies. You know, like,
she orders a hamburger, and that's cool, but she's very skinny.
Yes.
Like,
yeah.
Those
we're
kind of things.
Yeah. Okay.
You want it
anyways,
all. Sorry.
The long and the short.
No, but this is great. I love
this. We were revealing the things that we were that we had never acknowledged were influenced by something other than, oh, I'm just like that. But when we took the layer, when we dug into the layers and were like, oh my God, I'm doing that because I've been taught from the moment I've had breath to be a certain way because of men's control.
You know, I mean, I, from a fairly young age, thought that I was attracted to women. And still, I was very much observing myself from a male point of view. So that's even sadder.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not even trying to get sex out of it. I'm just trying to get approval or something, right? And that's because I felt I had a chip on my shoulder because I was a homo and damaged or appeared to be damaged because of that. But so for me, so I had a list of male filmmakers that were my ideal. Didn't even cross my mind that there were no women on that list. Mm-hmm. I remember saying, like, I squirmed thinking that I said this sentence. Yeah, I don't know if women will ever be able to read the news because they don't have as much natural authority as men. I said this, you know, for a long, long time ago. But so it's so clear that, you know, sexism and the disrespect for women is really, really profound. So when I saw these women, you know, telling that story and then recognized it even in my life, then I thought, okay, well, we got to get that out. But then what's so great about it isn't just like, hey, people, you got to learn this lesson from us who know better than you. It was really, really intimate and honest and true about a mother dying. And it was really truthful about how we beat ourselves up and how we look at ourselves from the outside. It was really, really, it was really exposed. So I loved that because it wasn't just teaching. Because, you know, like if you're in a conversation with someone and they're just teaching you stuff, you want to shoot them. It's called mansplaining, actually, right? You want to shoot them. So it doesn't just teach. It actually feels in front of you. Yeah, it's a confession, like. Yeah.
Well, and it's also really important to us, I think, was in the making and the doing, that we acknowledge that we're not getting it right still. Like, it's an ongoing process. It's messy. It's not like we figured out the answer.
Mm.
There's really just messy. All these problems, and I'm confused.
She's a mess, this character, and that's just so fabulous about her. And she's kind of mean sometimes, which we really like.
And she's soft sometimes.
And then she's adorable.
She's
what did you think of her? That character, like, played by two people.
Yeah, and although it was really interesting to see, like, you know, you'd be in the bar or something, you'd be talking to something, and then all of a sudden your voice would just come in,
mm-hmm.
right? And just to observe the two personalities,
yeah.
right? About because I was going to say, like, we often see, you know, different, you know, the same actor play two different characters, right? And I think this kind of turns it on its head where you see two actors
play
the same character. How much in terms of the translation from stage to screen, how much adaptation was there? How different was it? Because I know, like, you fleshed out the character of the mother, for example. You fleshed out Danny a little bit, a couple others. What was that process like?
Well, we did it together, but the process was mostly humanizing them, taking from kind of caricature to reality. So we're nicer to them. They're more real people in the film. And they just, we added the mother, we added the whole Christmas story, we added the eulogy at the end, we added the sex scene, we added things that we felt it needed to be a full, and we added a storyline, basically. It was much more episodic before, which just wasn't for a second boring on stage, but I was worried about it. I think the demands for kind of a narrative drive are stronger, are higher in film. So that's something else we added. And then we were thinking, because I'm older, I think that we aged it up a little bit. Like, there's the young girls, the young women, but there's also the mother character. So I think the ultimate tone of the thing lands somewhere in between.
Mm-hmm.
Or the ultimate kind of emotional maturity of it lands somewhere in between. It's younger and angrier as a play. And it's got a little bit more tenderness and some grief and... a more understanding, I think, maybe, as a film.
You guys are also older than when you wrote it, too, right?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah,
when we do the play, our favorite audience to do the play for is teenage girls.
Oh, really?
Because they...
I didn't know that.
It, like, explodes
teenagers.
Yeah. Because, you know, when it's people our age or older, it's things you've heard before.
Right.
Or you know about, and
yeah.
It's maybe not in this way, and it still impacts them, but it's like a recognition.
Yeah.
And for some of the teenagers who've done it in high schools, it's like the first time that
yeah.
these things are occurring to them, and you can hear the wheels turning.
Yes.
And then, like, crying and hugging and needing us to talk to them afterwards. And really, someone said recently to us, she was a university student, so she was like 19 or something. She said, I came to your play last night, and I went home afterwards, and I looked at myself in the mirror, and I realized I've been looking at myself through the eyes of a man for my whole life. And it's like you lifted the lens slightly
mm-hmm.
for the first time. And she started crying.
She said, I saw myself for
yeah.
the very first time.
Unbelievable. That's really chills.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that is different. I think this does land a little bit.
Yeah. And I think older women who maybe wished that they could have had careers or maybe wished that they could have raised their families and done something else, which is kind of a fair request since men have been able to do that for most of their lives. That they feel a kind of grief for lost potential.
Yeah.
And I think younger women are more sympathetic to older women who maybe like just stayed home and weren't like superpower career ladies like us. No, but you know, like that there's a kind of a, so yeah, anyways, there's a tonal shift. And then, of course, it went from, yeah, abstract and big and theatrical to, I was very committed right from the beginning. I knew that if you're going to take some crazy idea, like two people playing one person, then the filming, the style has to be really naturalistic. Everything has to be just dead real. It has to feel like a documentary. But then on top of that, still visually, like the lensing of it, the camera work of it, throwing half the frame out of focus, you know, adding crazy colors, splintering the image through refractions, through looking through, you know, beveled glass and anything reflective. So it was a whole series, like, so naturalistic but heightened from a lensing point of view. Anyway, that's what we did.
You mentioned grief a lot, and obviously, you know, this film deals with Cassandra trying to write a eulogy. But have you thought about the concept of grief and how we deal with it and how you think what this film can teach us about going through something like that?
Is there something that you felt like when you?
I mean, I'm fortunate that I haven't lost a parent yet. So, but I've lost grandparents. So you know, I can speak to that on that. And it sometimes I think, at least for me, it can take a while to process because you don't know what to feel, or you think you're supposed to feel a certain thing, but you feel something else, and you're like, why? I think grief just leads to questions, personally, at least in some stage of it.
Well, I've lost my mother when I was about 30, early 30s, and then I just lost my father recently, so I kind of know what it is to lose a parent, and you're totally right. You just... things bubble up that you did not expect at all. Like, things come rushing forward that are, it's not just, you know, oh, sudden some crying and oh, I miss them. Like, it's anger can come forward, or a sense of freedom can come forward, or just even facts about them. I had, look at that weirdness. I had, this sudden feeling when my mother died is like, oh my God, I have her hands. And it never crossed my mind. So this sense of physical connection can happen when, I don't think the film really gives any tips on it. It just reveals it on how, it reveals the stunnedness.
Something audience members have said to us is that they appreciate that we recognize and allow there to be humor in the grief as well.
Yes.
That sometimes like, you're making jokes and things are funny, even in
the
saddest
yeah.
time, that there's a kind of wandering path in the grief, and it's not direct to sadness. It includes those, like you're saying, things coming up that
yeah.
aren't appropriate in the moment.
Yeah.
But they are, that they're real.
A big thing in the process that Amy and Nora use is just take it from life, take it from life, take it from life. And that's been my approach too. When you're going back to, oh, I've seen this great scene, or oh, I know this film that did this way, this, like, then you're doing like a photocopy of a photocopy. Like, why not just go right to the source? So everything that happens in this movie happened to one of us, or maybe more than one of us sometimes. But so that is, so it's just, and I think there's something, people recognize that. People, when they watch it, they go, that feels real. Oh yeah, that feels real. I don't know why that feels so real, but that feels real.
Well, on that note, you said you realized after you finished filming that, you made this film for your mother. And I know in the credits, you dedicate the film to all your mothers.
Yeah.
Although
it was my father that had just died, or was on the verge
yeah.
of dying. Yeah, I was going on weekends, I was going to his deathbed, kind of. Anyway, yes, but so I was aware of the irony of all that.
But I was just going to comment on, like, what do you think this story tells us about the relationship we have with our parents, or parents' expectation or perceptions of who we are.
Even really loving mother-daughter relationships or parent-child relationships are full of little, I call them crimes of the heart, like little wounds that you remember and even nourish, you know, like you can savor them for some crazy reason. And then you put them in your movie. just little insults or something that we remember that stick. Like, so I think even because the relationship is pretty good between, it's not like a dysfunctional, horrible relationship at all. It's pretty good between that mother and that daughter. They share a lot in their fights aren't big. You know, she does say she's wasted her whole life, but she's drunk.
She was drunk.
There's love.
And there's love in it. And she says it because she knows that the value of her mother, and she wished she would have done more.
And she's reacting off of her mother selling herself short.
Yeah.
Why do you keep putting yourself down, stupid Elaine, and all this?
Yeah.
Why don't you do something?
Yeah.
So she says it
in a really brutal way.
In an unfortunate way.
So yeah, so even when there's a lot of love, I think we hurt each other pretty hard, horribly, I think. Just, yeah, stop doing that, man.
A lot of people react to this film with, they want to call their mothers.
Yeah.
Common.
I envision like a British mail, you know, like a British phone box, you know, those red ones that we just put in the lobby, and then it's like, call your mother, and we'll say in
court. There's a bank of quarters sitting there.
Yes.
You mentioned that one of the scenes you added for the film was a sex scene. And I found that scene tender, but also really funny at the same time. And I think it's because, Nora, you're sitting there watching. And for some reason, that was just quite a... It's bizarre, right? Like, it is a little bit bizarre. I guess how was that for you, the process of filming that, but you have to just sit there and watch your good friend make love to somebody else.
we intercut between her.
Right.
She's sometimes having sex and she's sometimes sitting there and watching. So it was back and forth.
Right.
We both had to make love. And watch. I mean, that is a good example of something that Amy and I talked when we were first writing the play, those like deep admissions of like, when I'm having sex, which should be the most out of your head and in
unguarded.
Your feeling time, in your life, I'm still thinking, I probably look ugly in this position. There's a roll on my stomach. This isn't the right, I should move. I'm mimicking.
Might be even more self-conscious in that because you're naked than at other times when you're sitting and having dinner.
Yeah, totally.
So in this one, you're supposed to be
because
naked without artifice.
A million times. He's definitely seen that.
Yeah.
Many, many times on camera. So there's like an iconic way it's supposed to look.
The
yeah,
porn angles.
Look
I don't look that way or sound that way or whatever it is.
But I think that it was also important to us that it had a sense of humor because it is absurd and ridiculous. Like, if you look at it from an outside perspective. It's like,
well, sex is absurd too.
Yeah,
so
yeah, it's all funny. It's all funny to us, but
yeah,
but
especially heterosexual sex. I don't know.
Kidding.
No, it was a fun scene to play. It was like, I mean, it was intense and like private.
Well,
and
that, and Ishan, the guy, the boyfriend, ex-boyfriend, he's a friend of theirs, and it was really important to me that comfort and respect
yeah.
would be there, because it
yeah.
could have got weird really fast. I mean, it's totally weird, let's be
yeah.
honest, but it could have become icky weird in the process, and it wasn't. He was lovely. He'd done nudity before. He understood the whole concept of he'd seen the play, he
yeah.
knew you guys. And,
yeah, it was safe.
And, I mean, but it is a little funny. He really is just an
object.
One, and I want, you know, I want to turn it out, because I think, Amy, you know, you touched on it, how in a way we're conditioned to react a certain way when we see female nudity, but we don't really see the full frontal male nudity that often like we did in this film. Obviously, I'm guessing that was a very conscious decision on all your parts, and Isha was obviously comfortable with that, but what do you think that says about how we, I guess, visualize these things in society and what we're told about the different bodies, you know, the different genders and all that?
I think, you know, women have been naked on screen more because men have been, heterosexual men have been behind the camera. And they just are, they point the camera at what they want to see. And they don't necessarily want to see another guy's dick there because they don't want to compare themselves and they're just not interested. So it's reflective of the fact that it's a female behind the lens. But it's also, I think, men don't want to be as vulnerable necessarily. And it's fine for women to be vulnerable in male films, but it's not fine for the men to be vulnerable. Men are generally kind of, they're so clever, they're so smart, they're so dominating, they get the girl and they win the prize and they, you know, they, but that's the cliche. And of course, there's lots of very intelligent, beautiful, artful films that don't do that, but still they don't want to see men being vulnerable. And so and nudity is vulnerability. So it just felt like it was equal to have male nudity and female nudity in the same sex scene. It's also just, it's just real. It's just real. Like, in a sexual encounter,
you don't roll over and pull the sheet around.
Yes, or get out of bed with your underwear on. I think
it
was
still
happening. Yeah, something.
It was 6 feet under.
What was it?
Yeah,
like, roll
over and pull it
out. Yourself. Yeah.
Like, this famous
who's
trick
ever
no one's
done
ever done.
Yeah.
In life.
Yeah. So it's just realism. It's just reality, and I don't know whether I spent too much time in France or something, but like where nudity is not a big deal. And I think somehow, in fact, I think in feminism in North America especially, there's a bit of an anti-sex strain through feminism, and I understand how women don't want to be like toys that men display in their movies, so they resist it, but you can't be anti-sex or anti-nudity in my mind. Yeah, I mean, you can do anything you want, but I can't be, you know? So I'm pro-sex feminist. I'm pro-nudity filmmaker. So that's why. That's what you see is bits. You want to get... What do you think? You resisted having his thing hanging out for a while.
Well, it was just... We saw it in the cut. And at first, I was like, I don't understand why we need a dick. And then you fought for it. And I was like, okay,
I understand
why we need a dick.
Ironically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, but it took me a while to come around. I just was like, it's also such a specific shot. I was like,
what do you mean?
Like, he just walks up and then his dick is hanging there. It's
well,
like a very, very strong dick shot.
Well, it's wide shot, though. Maybe we had the
I
close up before.
Had, no, it's true. That was the one.
It wasn't a close up on his dick.
Let's
be clear.
it was
closer.
Amy's head and then his dick.
Like, oh, that's right.
That was the shot.
It just felt too
like
deliberate.
It's like, here's a dick.
You're right.
But that ended up going.
And now it's in a more wider show. But it shocks people. It's actually,
yes, it does.
It's shocking. I don't know why.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like it's the first dick on film, but it's still, you
it's
really
rare.
Rare. Pardon?
It's rare.
It's so rare, yeah.
You've talked a lot about feminism, and I know this, the play initially was written sort of 2013, 2014, before everything in Hollywood and like before we heard all that, and yet it strikes me as a very, very relevant film.
Thank you.
Today. Where do you think this story fits in to the cultural conversation that we're currently experiencing?
I think this story, thanks to Amy and Nora's foresight and initial play, and then our work together, I think it gives voice to a whole, gender, a whole half of the human population figuring out what it is to take control of your own life and your own self-perception. And I think that's what's happening. And for the whole history of humanity, women have believed that they are there for the service of children and men. And they've somehow just bought into it. And they've somehow believed that how they look should please the men. And how they behave should please the men and then service and raise the children well. And they're just starting, we are just starting to truly come to believe that, oh my goodness, I get to decide what my life looks like or how I dress or whether I emphasize this part of my body or that part of my body or I don't emphasize my physical appearance at all. So I think we're just at the, like, it's 2 seconds after 2 seconds after midnight, for women starting to come to really, truly believe in their heart of hearts that they have as much right to run the show and to run their own lives as anybody else. I think if we're just starting, we're baby steps.
Yeah,
on
the
that.
Concern is that it's, I mean, this isn't that it, I mean, it's trendy in a way, but that we can't stop screaming about this. When we premiered the play, when we first premiered in 2015, Gomeshi had just been acquitted. And then it got remounted in Toronto, and everyone said, this is so relevant now. Now it's relevant, 2015. Then it got remounted again in Toronto for the next year. Trump was elected. Everyone said, now this is really relevant. It got relevant. And then it got remounted a third time in Toronto a year later, and Weinstein just was going down right around us, and everyone said, well, now this show, now this play, we need it now, it's really relevant now. So it's so great this is a film that can just be replayed over and over until it's irrelevant. Hopefully that will happen in a few generations.
But it's also, look at what's happening south of the border. There's laws being made to take rights away from women, and we just can't stop. We can't get tired.
The backlash is building too.
And it's like, there is no kind of, the cultural conversation is now, and then it's going to evolve, and we'll be over with this, because for the whole history of humanity, that hasn't happened. So we just have to keep our
voices. Oh, it's a dangerous moment. It's a dangerous moment. Like, it feels all very exciting to march and to have a Me Too, our very own hashtag, it feels exciting to call yourself feminist and fuck the patriarch and whatever, but there's fear underneath it. There's fear because
the people
so
with money and power.
Can you imagine being in Alabama and you get pregnant by your mistake and from some horrible person that you don't like, and there you have to have the baby? But it's like, it's a male control over women that is terrifying.
It's a dystopian.
It's terrifying.
Insanity is becoming our reality.
And yeah.
Around us, backpedaling to the Middle Ages.
And somehow when you're in it, like when we're living in one of the most progressive societies there is, it's just hard for us to imagine rights being retracted, but it's so possible. History is full of,
our
steps back.
Irrelevant.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
Abortion will be made irrelevant.
Oosterhof.
Canadian. Conservative.
Quickly, because I know Ellie wants us to wrap up.
Okay.
But one thing I think you also mentioned was that it was kind of a love story to Toronto. In a way. What sort of made you consciously want to feature specific, like, you know, you have the communist daughter, or you have, you know, this Toronto building, or this Toronto.
It, what's funny is that when foreign audiences who don't know Toronto at all, they don't think about that, and they kind of apply the film to their city. So it's actually, it's a win-win, right?
Yeah.
Because then the Torontonians look at it and go, oh, there I am. There's, I just hit myself in the face. There I am. There's my city. There's the streetcar tracks that my bicycle gets caught in. There's my streetcar. There's, that was important, that, of that kind of little detail of that, because that seems to be a complete Toronto experience.
The streetcar tracks
with your biking,
yeah.
Right?
People,
I don't, not a lot of other cities have that. I know, there's the people have PTSD when they watch this. The Torontonians do. Maybe I wonder if San Franciscans do, too. Like,
yeah. Nice.
Nice, are there streetcar tracks? Okay, so Nice, there's lots of
those three cities.
Yeah, we wanted to, we tried to show a kind of a diversity, too. Like, there's not, it's not all, you know, white people. That was a bit, that's that a bit of a way of reflecting the real Toronto. We tried to show
this freezing snow.
The freezing snow, biking in the snow, the getting hot in the Eaton Center, getting hot in the store, and then your the scarf dragging behind you, all that irritation. There was all kinds of things. There's jokes at the party about, you know, raccoons and Canadian Tire. I didn't shy away. There's a, in Amy's song at the end, there's a talk about Boxing Day. All these things
milk
that
bags.
Are... Milk bags.
Nanaimo bars.
Nanaimo
yeah.
bars. Like, that's true. What else is there? Just that's Canadian. That's good. Milk bags. America's
yeah.
like, what is a milk bag?
I saw a meme recently that said someone asked me today, why Canadians say, oh no, yeah, for sure.
Oh.
Or, yeah, oh no, for sure. And it's like, I don't have an answer because I don't know why we do it.
Yeah, oh no, for sure.
Oh yeah, no, for sure.
Wow,
I love, for sure.
She's from Germany, the most Canadian expression of all the expressions was, just gonna squeeze past her.
Just gonna squeeze past you.
When I was teaching in South America, the Americans would ask me, "So why is the queen on your money?"
Yeah.
And what is bag? Why is the queen on your money? What is bag milk and poutine? Really? That
yeah,
that was like.
I know.
Those are three.
I wonder about those things.
Those are the three questions that I
always
get.
I don't like bag milk. I think bag milk's the way to go. The queen isn't the way to go.
No.
The queen should go.
No, let's
and poutine.
Cheese
so
on
keep it, yeah.
Chips on gravy.
With gravy. It's just to makes the fries soggy.
Like, you gotta eat it fast.
Oh, is that it?
Depends how you make your fries.
Pardon me?
Depends how you make the fries.
Yeah, the fries have to be like super crispy.
Yeah.
I do think it is important to make Canadian content that takes pride in being Canadian, because so much of Canadian content pretends to be American. And it, like, never allows us to get over our inferiority complex.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's a lot of really great things being made here, but it's also, like, there could be so much more, and let's, like, pump ourselves
yeah.
up and make things that are here and are ferociously here.
Yeah, and we have a small population, so there's never going to be that much Canadian content, just because there's, you know, that not that many Canadians compared to the American population. But I really have found that if you dive into the detail of your square inch of the world with love, and not just selling it and promoting it, but just love and scrutiny and seriousness and humor, like, just take it seriously, that's what's going to have reality, and that's what's going to be That's actually gonna sail. That's gonna go far.
sail far on the high seas in the 70s.
Well, the film is Mouthpiece, a fantastic little slice
Thank
of...
Thank you for doing your homework on this. It's clear that you actually read about it and thought about it.
Well, you know, I try to be at least somewhat informed when I...
No, it's great. It makes a big difference. Thank you.
Patricia, Amy, Nora, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Come see it.
That was my conversation with director Patricia Rosema and actors and writers Amy Nussbacken and Nora Sadava. Their film Mouthpiece opens on Friday. Just for the record, the film that was talked about there with... Olivia Wilde and Oscar Isaac, and written by Dan Fogelman, was called Life Itself. Moving on. My next guest is an Egyptian filmmaker who has also studied in New York. Several years ago, he worked on a documentary called The Colony, which was about a colony of lepers in Egypt. And out of that, was born his first feature script, which is the film Yom HaDin. As I mentioned in the opening, there was a bit of a technical issue, and the first couple of minutes, the first part of his answer to the question got cut off, but I've done my best to recreate it. So I apologize if there's any gaps between when I ask and when he answers, but sometimes these things happen. So here is my interview with Aboubakar Shoki on his film Yom HaDin. Aboubakar Shoki, hello. Welcome to Endeavors. Thanks for being here today. Your film is Yom HaDin, and... how did this film start for you? I know that it was born out of a documentary that you worked on previously.
It's kind of interesting how it started. It was initially written for the protagonist of my documentary, which was this woman that was working in something called the Garbage Mountain there. But by the time we were ready to shoot, we were preparing for the film, she was physically too weak to be able to actually perform in that role. So I had to start looking for other people. And, you know, Aradi was one of the first people that were kind of referred to me. He was, it came to a casting and we just had this instant connection. It was just a really great energy. It was a funny person. He knew this story very well. It's like almost like he lived it himself. And so I just, I was a little worried about like casting a first person that walked through a door, but like really that kind of almost what happened. I was very lucky and very fortunate to have worked with him.
Just on that note, because you mentioned how it was initially going to be a female protagonist. How much did the story changed when the protagonist went from female to male?
Not that much, actually, because, what it was supposed to be is supposed to tell the story of somebody who survived leprosy and travels across Egypt to find his family. And along the way, he has this companion who is this little boy that helps them, in the garbage field. I imagine that, it was a woman playing that role. It would have been, of course, much more, her struggle would have been much more difficult, magnified. But it is already very difficult for somebody with leprosy to travel through a country. So, the difficulty was already there, kind of. Those are the things that I think were part of it.
And I know this film, it wasn't nominated, but it was chosen as Egypt's submission for the foreign language film at the 91st Academy Awards. What went through your head when you found out that piece of information?
It was great. We've been very blessed with how the film has, had been received by that point. We're very happy to have our premiere in Cannes, and then we, just kind of, things kind of snowballed from there. Also being nominated by your country, with a small film like that. We had a very small budget. We were like first time filmmakers, no big stars attached. It was a good moment for us, and we it took us 5 years to make this film, so it felt like a nice award.
What is the process like to get a film made not only in Egypt but in the Middle East? I can't imagine it's a particularly easy process.
Well, Egypt has a very big industry. I mean, it's a big, a very big history in cinema, but also like a very expansive industry, which is largely commercial to a big extent. There's big budget and big stars, and they provide films for the entire region to an extent, commercial films mostly. So there wasn't much space for us with our small indie film. It wasn't even part of the indie scene. We're even, I think, less than that. That was always a little difficult. In a way, though, I think it might have helped us because, to an extent, nobody really took us seriously, and it kind of helped us to just, go through a lot of the bureaucracy and a lot of the regular things that people didn't really like look out for us very much. So I think it also helped us in a paradox way.
And I know Dean, the producer, had a big part to play in this. In terms of trying to get the funding and raising the money, how difficult was it, and how did you have to navigate all the different possible avenues that there are, especially for a film like this?
Well, I mean, we knocked on a lot of doors. I think, we were very lucky to get some private grants from, through NYU and it was just difficult to generally like go through the regular channels. And we went to Kickstarter, we went, to a lot of private donors. We had to just basically knock on a lot of doors and not lose hope. And we were very lucky to have had these private investors, these private donors that ended up helping us to make that film.
And you had something very lucky happen. You had your debut feature play at the Cannes Film Festival. Which is rare for a debut film to be played in competition. How did that come about, and what went through your head the first time you set foot at Cannes?
It was great to be there to do that. We had spent such a long time making that film that, in the end, like having a world premiere at Cannes, it's kind of every filmmaker's dream, really. Like, it doesn't really get better than that. So, felt very blessed. It was a very humbling experience to be there and you show your film. And, when we made it, we really wanted to make a film that we kind of, a film that we believed in, a film that we thought it would be nice to put that in theaters. And, we thought we hadn't, it's like a world that hasn't really been shown in a cinema before. So we wanted to do that, and to end up premiering in Cannes was just, a very, amazing experience. And we were very, very lucky to have had that.
Both in your documentary and in the film, what were some things you learned about leprosy, and where do you think some misconceptions society has about lepers?
I mean, the biggest one was really, which I mean, I learned doing the documentary, is that, first of all, like the value of like health generally, and how there were people that told me, they're very rich, but they have a lot of money, but like they wish they could go buy health with it. And I thought that was kind of a profound statement for me. We always take that for granted in a way. And then the other thing is that it's mostly or leprosy specifically is mostly a social issue and not a medical one, because the medical aspect, you can get cured from the advancement of the disease itself. But then, the scars remain, and then you get socially shunned in a way, and you have to, basically you find yourself living in a colony, because you feel more comfortable there, and because you're not getting the same opportunities that you are getting, you would be getting inside the colony. So that was for me like an interesting aspect of it, that, that it's more of a social issue than a medical one.
Why, and I guess it speaks to a larger issue. Why do you think we are as a society so quick to shun people who maybe are different or look different than the rest of us?
It's really, I think it's upbringing. Like, it's just the way we treat, we you know, teach our children to be or to deal with others. We live in a world, I mean, it's a general thing, really. It's not just, you know, in regards to leprosy. If you look around yourself, like, there's, you know, everyone's just like, fear of the other is something that's constantly drummed into you. And it's also between, like, countries and cultures and worlds. And, you know, it's something that's very unfortunate. And I really think it goes back to, like, how you were brought up and, you know, what you tell the next generation to be like.
So in a way, I think, you know, given the current, international political climate that we're in, this film is very timely in saying, you know, let's not fear others. Let's come together. Have you thought about where your film fits in our sort of current cultural moment that we're having right now?
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, in its nature, it's a film about, like, two underdogs that try to make it in a world that doesn't really accept them. So, you know, you can read anything into it. I mean, it doesn't really, you know, have to be about leprosy specifically. It's not really, you know, about Egypt specifically. This film could take place anywhere in the world and probably would have the same, you know, effect in terms of, like, how society deal with people that they don't really understand. So I hope that, you know, I don't really believe that films create a change on a massive level, but I hope that on an individual level, at least, you know, if somebody comes out of it and, you know, changes his mind, you know, that's enough.
What is the reaction to the film like been in your home country?
It's been really good. Like, we were very lucky with it. Like I said, you know, it's mostly a very commercial environment with, you know, big budget and big stars, and we didn't have neither. But we came out at a time where, you know, we didn't even have enough money to put up billboards and stuff in the streets. But, you know, we had a lot of word of mouth, a lot of people just recommending it. And then initially we were told we were going to last like a week in theaters, but we ended up lasting, I think it was 2.5 or 3 months. So, you know, that was for an indie film, you know, with that small budget and no big stars attached, that was, you know, a huge deal for us. And we were very lucky with it.
You went to NYU. I know you're in New York right now. What is the American and international response been like to this little film?
I mean, it's been great so far. We had our premiere in Cannes. We had several releases over the past year. I've been traveling a lot through for releases, theatrical releases for festivals, and now it's coming out, you know, here in New York and LA on the 31st. So, you know, it's been good. You know, like I said, you know, initially we made this film, we just wanted to, you know, make a film that we thought was different and we'd love people to see it, you know, if we're lucky enough. And, you know, I'm very happy that we were able to do this.
You joked about, you know, how you didn't have any celebrities in the film, but Rady's kind of become a celebrity in his own right, hasn't he? a little bit, I've heard.
Yeah. Yeah, he's not, well, in Egypt, he's him and the little boy, Ahmed, they're both, you know, they're both like semi-celebrities now. They do a lot of interviews, they, you know, have appearances, in a way, he's become the face of, you know, that struggle, that disease that nobody really has heard of before and that, you know, has been kind of misunderstood and neglected for so long. And I feel it's very sweet that now they are famous where, you know, a couple of years ago, people really would, you know, mistreat them in a way.
And Ahmed, the little boy, do you think he's going to continue acting at all?
I hope so. He has big dreams. He wants to, you know, be a big actor. He has a lot of, like, big stars that he wants to be like in Egypt. But he also, like, he's only in eighth grade now, and, you know, he has to focus on school. I think, like, the deal that's being made is with, you know, his family is that he has to, like, finish school and make sure that he, like, is a good student, and then, you know, he can focus on acting.
You know, you've done the feature film, you've done the documentary. Is this journey in chronicling leprosy finished for you, or do you think there's more to tell?
I'm not sure. I mean, there's always more to tell. Like, I always think about, like, wow, I mean, that world is so vast and big. Like, there's so many things, from so many angles, so many stories I could tell. I mean, it's probably not going to be the next film that I do, but it's definitely something that I feel like I'll keep coming back to it in a way, because it's just such a fascinating subject.
You know, whenever a director from outside of Hollywood makes a film in their own country and it becomes a success, inevitably Hollywood or America will come calling and ask you to, you know, ask someone to direct a big blockbuster. Is that something you aspire to do?
Well, I mean, you know, I go and make films where they want me to go and make films, you know, and like wherever I feel welcome, wherever I feel like, you know, there's something there that, you know, they want me to do for them. I mean, I'd like to feel, you know, to go to a place and work there where, you know, I'm welcome. So, yeah.
So you mentioned it's not necessarily the next one we're going to be doing, but do you have another project currently in the works?
Yeah, I have a bunch of projects I'm working on right now. Next one is something that's a co-production between Egypt and Austria, which is half Austrian too. So I'm trying to, you know, involve that in my next project. And yeah, we'll see.
You know, given that artists are always working on so many projects at any given time, how do you decide or how do you know? Is it just like, oh, I have the funding, so this is going to be the next one I do? Or how do you decide, I think this one is, I guess, closer to being ready than this one or this one?
I'm not really sure how others do it. Like, for me, it's more, you know, something that I feel like, there's like 100 things I would like to do next, but there's like one thing that's like, I really want to do that one next. And it's just something that's kind of your gut feeling, where you feel this one feels right, and something that's close to you, something that you feel that you can do and nobody else can do in that same way. So that's really how I approach it.
You mentioned you're half Austrian, so do you think you'll make either a German language film or a film in Austria to reflect that side of you?
Yeah, I might even be trilingual. It's kind of how I grew up, you know, between German, Arabic, and English. You know, so maybe the next one is going to be trilingual. We'll see.
The film is Yom Adin, and I believe it opens on May the 31st,
yep.
Which is this Friday. A.B. Shaki, thanks so much for your time today, man.
Thanks for having me.
Alrighty, have a good day. Cheers.
You too.
That was my conversation with director Abubakar Shaki. His film is Yom Adin, and it is in theaters now. That does it for me today. My thanks to Patricia Rosema, Amy Nostrakin-Narsadava, and Abubakar Shaki. This weekend, I will have Eve Harlow and Sky Wallace on the program. So stay tuned for that. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next time. Bye for now.